Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuc, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president and CEO and political observer Alan Shartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue are joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing the most important issues of the week. On Monday, March 29th, Joe and Alan were joined by Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, political consultant and lobbyist, Libby Post, and Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic, Sarah Rogerson.
The situation at the border and the Mexico border continues to consume the Biden administration. The attention along the border has been really at the top of their agenda. And the reason is because this record number of migrant teenagers and children crossing into the United States without their parents at a rate that far exceeds the government's ability to care for them. But as they race to add shelter capacity for these minors, Department of Homeland Security officials are privately warning about what they see as the next phase of migration surge. That could be the largest in two decades, driven by a much greater number of families. DHS expects approximately 500,000 to 800,000 migrants to arrive as part of a family group during the 2021 fiscal year that ends in September, a quantity that would equal or exceed the record numbers who entered in 2019, according to government data reviewed by the Washington Post, the article that I'm reading from. Officials are racing to find facilities to house these families ahead of their release, along with additional staff to process an increase in humanitarian and asylum claims. So, Sarah, let's begin with you. I'm curious, first of all, of what you made of the president's remarks at the end of last week and how you deal with this current crisis while you are also getting ready for this surge that could go into September if these numbers are correct.
I'm following more closely as opposed to what the president is saying, because I think on this issue, it's really more important to pay attention to what DHS officials are saying at this moment. He's putting all the right people in place. So he's acting the way an executive who's staffing a quote unquote crisis, which I'll explain in a second. Like these are predictable waves of migration. These are not, you know, every year we have a surge in a crisis. And if you have it every year, it's not a crisis, it's a pattern. So, you know, some of his comments are just so, you know, sort of 10,000 feet perspective that they don't really say much of anything, which is sort of his job at that level. And then to put the people in place who actually have the expertise and the knowledge, because immigration is so highly technical and is such a disastrous mess after the Trump administration, it's important to note that, and I always go to the American Immigration Council, and I would drive every listener there because they currently have an explainer of like the top five facts you need to know about what's happening at the border that are not sensationalized by the media for whatever story will sell their paper, that are not, you know, political statements. It's a nonprofit think tank that focuses solely on immigration. And one of the things that they note is that this current rise actually began in April of 2020 when President Trump instituted what's called Title 42. That was the public health authority, right? Remember that Pence went to the CDC and sort of obtained over their objection to say, we will keep people from coming into this country as a matter of public health because of COVID, even though all evidence points to the contrary in terms of migration being the cause of spread. It's more likely that anti-maskers in border states are a greater cause of spread in those states than migrant populations.
Amongst us, you are the one who obviously will have a handle on what, I mean, it's nice to say that the president is appointing the right people, but if you were one of those people, what would you do now?
Well, I would do a lot of the things that they're doing. So one thing is that they're trying to rapidly staff up the statutorily required care for unaccompanied minors. So the children who technically arrive here without a parent or guardian, but maybe arriving with an aunt or an uncle or another family member, or they may be truly unaccompanied and arriving alone. There's a whole mix of the statutory definition of unaccompanied minor leaves open a large swath category of individuals. So they're trying to staff up the Health and Human Services and Office of Refugee Resettlement response, which is really to provide an appropriate child-centered setting in order to resettle any accompanied minor who's presenting. In terms of families coming, unfortunately, what the president is doing is not what I'd be doing or advising him to do, and that is he's still turning away 72% of all people encountered at the border. 72% of people who are presenting themselves at the southern border are being turned away under the Biden administration. I would advise him to allow any of those families who have asylum claims to process them in the regular course. The problem is we have all this pent-up demand. We had refugee camps that he had to that the Biden administration worked very quickly, I might add, with UNHCR and other international humanitarian organizations to make sure that those were cleared out, because those were becoming targets of cartels and organized crime. People were being kidnapped. It was a humanitarian crisis. That was a real crisis created by the Trump administration. But the other thing that I would do is send more immigration judges to the border and immigration authorities, not Customs and Border Patrol or the military or the enforcement arm of the Department of Homeland Security in terms of expelling people at such high rates. We should process them and ramp up the processing that needs to be there.
One of the things that the president came under fire, I use that term very loosely, came under fire, but there were some concerns, as one of the question was a real life scenario of a child that came up, and what would you do with that child, and you would send them back to the parents. How problematic is that, and is that realistic considering the numbers that you're talking about?
Those are all really good questions. It's problematic for lots of different reasons. I've represented these kids. Sometimes what happens is this is a last-ditch effort from the family to protect the child from either being recruited into gang membership or killed. Sometimes their parents are killed after they flee because their parents did not produce them to whatever group was after them, whether it's exploited labor, whether, there's a ton of different reasons. Or families living in poverty, the governments are unable to support their own people. They're living under terrible circumstances, and somebody in the family is going to starve if the children are sent back, right? Like there's no option. There's no good answer other than that's the only reason why people send their children, is if there's no other option. It's not to create what the Trump administration would call an anchor to bring in other people. One thing everyone needs to remember is that unaccompanied children are specifically in certain circumstances, in most circumstances, are not able to petition for their family members to come across. Is a part of what's called special immigrant juveniles, so children who are abused, abandoned, or neglected by one or both parents. So that's a particular subclass of unaccompanied minors, but they're statutorily barred from bringing those parents into the country. Now, is that humane? No. Do we have room? Yes. Remember, the Trump administration slashed refugee caps to historic lows. So we've been in a refugee deficit for about 4 years. That means like our economy, our infrastructure, economy-wise, has been gutted of talent, first of all, but also migrant labor for jobs that Americans don't want to do. So we have, there's a lot of moving parts, but I guess I would like to focus our listeners on the humanitarian aspect. Like, what would you do? What do you think, for those of you who are parents out there, what do you think it would take for you to send your kid alone to to Saskatchewan. Probably a lot.
Right. So, Alan, given that this...
Uh-oh.
What?
I haven't a clue. I mean, I just
Well, I'm interested in your thoughts about the president's handling of this and what people are talking about this, as Sarah rightly says, of calling it a crisis versus pattern, which is obviously a good point. But there is a lot of negative press coming the president's way because of the situation. Many, many Republicans, Lindsey Graham, Ted Cruz, and the like, have made their way to the border to bang their pots and pans and make a case out of this. So politically, how's the president handling this?
Well, I think it's a major problem for him. We have a wonderful defense attorney who defends people who are coming in on our panel, and she makes a lot of very good points. And then on the other side, you have a lot of Americans who want nothing to do with them and who think that, you know, we had 73 million Americans vote for Trump. And among them are many people who just don't want to see anybody else coming across that border. And so Trump had his way. He was mean. He was vicious. And he put all kinds of quotas on. But it's a hell of a political problem for the president. And I have to say, Joe, I really appreciate your not calling on me first this morning.
Well, I wanted Sarah
you did the right thing.
Set the table.
You did the right thing.
Libby.
You know, this is once again, you know, what the president Biden hasn't even been in office for 3 months yet, the first 100 days. And he's beset with all of these situations that he really had no hand in creating. But now he has to solve it all. You know, and this is another one of those situations where Trump set up a horrible situation at the border, a horrible way of handling immigration, demonizing anybody who wants to cross our border who isn't white, and probably male, but who definitely isn't white, and speaks English. And so, you know, he's caught between a rock and a hard place, trying to do the best he can, but it is so disingenuous for Lindsey Graham, Ted Cruz, or any of the Republicans who backed Trump's immigration policies to now go after Biden. But that's the way they do things. The GOP playbook is attack your opponent for doing what you've already done or for not being able to solve the problems that you created.
I think the answer is not to do things in secret. I would argue that the press needs to have access to the situation at the border. His response to can we have access, once things are fixed, sure, you can go in and look at what's happening. I think the media is being denied access, and that's wrong at this point. I know it looks bad, but reality is reality.
One of the questions that has come up is about press access to these sites. There was one camera crew from NBC that was allowed in, and that's been it. There are increased calls for more people to go down to see these sites. Alan, what do you make of that, and how politically troubling can that be for the Biden administration?
Well, it's incredibly, as I tried to indicate before, and one of the reasons I really have so little to say, because I don't know what I would do here. I understand that it is a humanitarian crisis, and I understand that, you know, there are people who are fleeing terrible, terrible circumstances in their home countries. And I know the politics of the country, and that's why Biden is going slow, are that, you know, you have to have closed borders.
But do you let the press in?
Oh, without question, I would let the press in. Because I think the moment you keep the press out, you are basically creating doubt in a lot of people's minds. And I think transparency is a great idea. There's got to be a reason, and I don't know what it is, but there's got to be a reason that they're not doing it. If they don't let the press in, there'll be swelling groups of people, Joe, who think that something is amiss. It will not help Biden, and this is probably his worst crisis that he has going now.
Sarah, how important is that visual and for the press to go in?
Well, it's tricky, right? Like, we know what the visual is. It's there every day of the week. It's like people are being processed in temporary housing facilities that are not meant to hold human beings for long periods of time. It looks terrible. So, you know, I always think that the more press, the better. But in this, and that's why the Republicans are like, well, if you won't do it, then we'll put this spectacle and we'll dress up in our camouflage hunting gear and jump on gunboats with the Department of Homeland Security. And that's the story that we'll tell in the press, which is, you know, problematic for so many reasons. And really distracts from the main issue. You know, they've gotta let more press in, or do a better job quicker, so that they aren't so embarrassed of what the press will see when they get there.
Libby, any thoughts?
No, I mean, this is really a rock and a hard place kind of thing. And I, you know, what are we gonna say? No, the press can't go. You know, we do have that thing in the Constitution called freedom of the press. I understand. I don't want the Biden administration to look like they're covering anything up.
Right.
I think this needs to be positioned in a way that shows that they're trying to take action and are to some respect, but also where the roots of this problem came from.
Here are some letters on this issue. David writes, can you please repeat the name, Sarah, of the website with the information concerning immigration facts and figures?
Yeah, it's the American Immigration Council. They're based in Washington, D.C., and they're a policy think tank / research organization around the issue of immigration. And they are consistently reliable in the information that they provide. And they have very easy to digest. What I love is that how accessible their information is. And more recently, if you look at the graphs cited in Washington Post, I don't know if it's this most recent one, and the New York Times last week, I think it was, You'll see that the credit is given to, in many cases, to American Immigration Council. So they're known as a reliable source for this kind of information.
AmericanImmigrationCouncil.org is the web address. And let's go to other letters. We go to Mark. Can you elaborate on the 72% being sent back? Are they coming to legal ports of entry, crossing illegally, getting caught and sent back, or both? Who is being sent back, and who are the 28% allowed to stay? In your opinion of those crossing illegally, what is the plan of the majority once they get here? What are their expectations? These questions will take us to the end of the show, I think. this, which is fine, Mark, but anyway, you can pick whatever ones you want here, Sarah. And do most turn themselves into Border Patrol agents voluntarily?
Yeah, we could spend a lot of time. There's a lot of facts and figures that go into the answers to these questions. The answers are not as easy as everyone would like them to be, and that's why we're in the situation that we're in. But I will say that according to the American Immigration Council, of the 72%, it says, while unaccompanied children and some families at the border have been allowed to come into the country and challenge their deportation in immigration court, they represent a fraction of overall entrants. In terms of the breakdown of the people who are being expelled, whether they're presenting at a valid point of entry or attempting to cross through outside of a checkpoint, I don't have those numbers here in front of me. Sometimes those numbers are difficult to obtain, not because people are trying to hide them, although the Trump administration did that constantly, but because it's hard to gather and quantify this information across a swath of the country that is extremely large. You're talking about multiple DHS checkpoints, multiple offices, multiple states that are involved, and multiple checkpoints / unpatrolled and patrolled border zones. And so to get the data on that sort of granular detail, at that sort of level of granular detail, sometimes takes a month after everyone's either processed and crossed or been sent back to report out, because you're gathering it from all these different sources, compiling it, making sure it's accurate. I will say, in terms of the percentage of people who present themselves to immigration court, the vast majority of people, once they cross, do report to immigration court.
Alan? Joe, we got a letter from our regular correspondent, Daisy, who really is good, who writes, "The border. I totally agree with Sarah and what she is saying. However, there are the politics of this. And the politics mean that the Biden administration will have to make certain decisions that people like Sarah and other advocates may not be happy with. However, I'm okay with those decisions if those decisions help us to re-elect a Democrat. I want a Democrat who will still handle this a lot more compassionately than a Republican president like Tom Cotton." And that's from Daisy.
Sarah?
There are lots of things that the Biden administration are doing that advocates are unhappy with. I really have a difficult time with this idea of, like, what are we going to do to reelect a Democrat? It's up to us, our imagination and our willingness to make it happen as we Democrats. I identify as a Democrat, a progressive Democrat. But, you know, I don't want our immigrants to suffer for want of a vision forward as a party.
Let's leave it at that. All right. Let's go to Mike. In paying attention to the news, I have noticed the one solution for dealing with the border crisis has not been mentioned, and it is the solution that Sarah Rogerson just mentioned, speeding up the asylum process. To me, that speeding up means adding more immigration judges. None of the big thinkers in Washington have talked about that.
Yeah, he's right. The immigration judge union has come out and said a bunch of things about what they need in order to do their jobs better. A lot of big thinkers have said that for years, that we need to staff up our asylum process. And the Trump administration surgically, systemically, and consistently undid our asylum laws. Undid the protections granted. It does take a while to stitch back together what they took 4 years to destroy.
Sarah Rogerson on the Roundtable panel last Monday, March 29th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. For Wednesday's Roundtable Panel, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue welcomed investigative journalist and UAlbany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo, Times Union columnist Chris Churchill, and Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin.
This story, I mean, there's a surface story, and then there's the backstory, and then there's the conjecture. And it is messed up, and it's very confusing, and I don't know what to think of it, but here we go. This is what we know at the moment, and obviously this is under an investigation and is part of a much larger investigation, and we will see. So this, the best synopsis of it I saw was in the New York Times, who broke the story. But Representative Matt Gaetz, Republican of Florida and a close ally of former President Donald Trump, is being investigated by the Justice Department over whether he had a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old and paid for her to travel with him, according to three people briefed on the matter. Investigators are examining whether Mr. Gaetz violated federal sex trafficking laws, the people said. A variety of federal statutes make it illegal to induce someone under 18 to travel over state lines to engage in sex in exchange for money or of something of value. The Justice Department regularly prosecutes such cases, and offenders often receive severe sentences. So it's not clear how Mr. Gates met the girl, believed to be 17 at the time of encounters about 2 years ago, that investigators are scrutinizing, according to two of the people. The investigation was opened in the final months of the Trump administration under Attorney General William Barr. Given Mr. Gates' national profile, senior Justice Department officials in Washington, including some appointed by Mr. Trump, were notified of the investigation. The three people said that the examination of Mr. Gates, who is 38, is part of a broader investigation into a political ally of his, a local official in Florida named Joel Greenberg. And this is where it all starts getting, like, super sketchy. Who was indicted last summer on an array of charges, including sex trafficking of a child and financially supporting people in exchange for sex, at least one of whom was underage. Mr. Greenberg, who has since resigned his post as tax collector in Seminole County north of Orlando, visited the White House with Mr. Gates in 2019, according to a photograph that Mr. Greenberg posted on Twitter. There are all kinds of photos with Mr. Green with this rogues gallery there's one with he, Mr. Greenberg, Matt Gaetz, and Roger Stone. They're all starting to come out now. No charges have been brought against Mr. Gates, and the extent of his criminal exposure is unclear. Mr. Gates said in an interview last night on, yes, Fox News, that his lawyers had been in touch with the Justice Department, and they were told he was the subject, not the target, of an investigation. I only know that it has to do with women, Mr. Gates said. I have a suspicion that someone is trying to recategorize my generosity to ex-girlfriends as something more untoward. We'll let it go there for the moment. Alan.
Thanks for calling on me, Joe. I always
I'm happy to go anywhere else. I just wanted to give you a first refusal.
I always appreciate that. Oh, well, the answer is that, you know, if in fact this turns out to be something he did, it's going to be very tough on him, no question. Number two, the major charge is hypocrisy. These are the guys who are pretending that they are on God's side, that they are always good, and in fact, it will hurt. Maybe it'll hurt. It didn't hurt Donald Trump, who, of course, is the greatest, espouser of his sexual relationships that we have seen. In fact, my wife has a T-shirt with all of his words on it. So I can only say that this is bad news for Gates and for his crowd. How did I do, Joe?
You know, it is. This is the story just gets weirder and weirder. So Mr. Gates called the investigation. He had a bunch of interviews yesterday, and he called the investigation part of an elaborate scheme involving false sex allegations to extort him and his family for $25 million that began this month. He said he and his father, Don, had been cooperating with the FBI and wearing a wire after they were approached by people saying they could make the investigation go away. Mr. Gates claimed the disclosure of the sex trafficking inquiry was intended to thwart an investigation into the extortion plot. In a second interview later Tuesday, the congressman said he had no plans to resign his House seat and denied that he had romantic relationships with minors. It is verifiably false that I have traveled with a 17-year-old woman, he said, which is different than I had a relationship with a 17-year-old woman. Rosemary, please enlighten us.
Okay, so my first view is, boy, am I enjoying even these accusations. If anyone deserves the pressure and humiliation of a federal investigation of their sex life, it is this gas bag who's just been an embarrassment in the Congress. And I hope he is withering in discomfort. Second, if we ever needed an illustration of the bad decisions teenagers make, going out with Matt Gaetz certainly fits that bill. And third, the whole ridiculous story that you've recounted here makes me think that QAnon's crazy theories are not exactly so crazy. This is another Jeffrey Epstein. What is it with politicians and young girls? Stop it.
Well, there's that, right? I feel horrible for the young women involved in this case. Not that there are multiple cases with Matt Gaetz. However, in the entire sex trafficking ring that is involved in this investigation, including Mr. Greenberg, there are a few minors, and that, of course, is just dreadful. Bob Griffin.
Yeah, let me dive headfirst into the septic tank, Joe. You know, there are a couple points here that I think are important, and it's easy to make light of the situation. It's easy to poke fun at Matt Gaetz, but I mean, it's a really serious situation if you think about it. I mean, they're talking about interstate trafficking of minors for sexual exploitation. I thought it was interesting. I saw the clip from Fox last night, and Gaetz tried to bring Tucker Carlson into this almost as a defendant. And if anyone sees it, it's really interesting because Carlson pushed back and said that he had no recollection of what Gaetz was trying to say. This is a continued problem. And you put your finger on it, Rosemary, that, you know, when we talk about the swamp, you know, using Trump's language, there is a problem. There is a problem in D.C. There is a problem with men in power and the people who run to elect who we elect to represent us. And Matt Gaetz is you know, I've always felt that he was unfit to hold office, and this just sort of proves it. But it's a serious crime, and this is a serious problem.
Tucker Carlson denies the Gaetz claim that he met the witness in FBI probes, and then went on to say it was one of the weirdest interviews I've ever conducted, meaning his interview last night with Matt Gaetz. So there is that.
Which is saying a lot. And the other point, Joe, that I really want to drive home, this investigation was started under the Barr administration, yeah, over justice. Okay, so when this is being portrayed as the Biden administration is going after, you know, poor GOPers, that's not the case. This was started under Barr.
Meanwhile, and not for nothing, I just want to point out that if you there were stories circulating about Matt Gaetz about 48 hours ago before these charges came out, that he was getting ready to mysteriously and weirdly pack it up and quit the Congress so he could go work at Newsmax, and had publicly said that he felt he could be a stronger voice there. I thought that was extremely weird at the time, 2 days ago. And now you get some idea of where maybe that was headed, of what he knew and when he knew it. Chris Churchill.
Yeah, I mean, that didn't strike me as that odd that he would leave Congress, because he's always been a little bit more of a media personality than a you know, a serious congressman anyways. But I did watch that interview with Tucker Carlson, and it was bizarre. You could see that Carlson was uncomfortable with a lot of it, including when Matt Gaetz named the supposed former DOJ official who he said was extorting him. I mean, named him by name.
So that just screws up the entire investigation, right? I mean, that's not you're not supposed to do that.
Well, you're not supposed to do what exactly? Name who's extorting you? I mean, if somebody was really extorting him, I can see why he might name the person. I mean, you know, there's obviously reasons to be suspicious of that story, but like you, as you said in the intro, it's an extremely convoluted and confusing story. I mean, I guess all we can be grateful for is that Florida politics are still as bizarre as they ever were. And, you know, I mean, it's just, you look at the cast of characters involved in this, including Roger Stone and some other people who, you know, have less than stellar reputations. And it's just, it's a little bit mind blowing. But that said, I Matt Gaetz does deserve the presumption of innocence. I mean, I don't think we should assume that the allegation is true just yet. I mean, there's a lot to this, apparently.
Josh, taking me into task, referring to these charges, and he's right. I should have said
yeah, there are no charges.
No charges. Yeah. Should have said allegations. Yeah. And also takes one of our panelists to task of saying what makes him unfit to serve, according to one of your guests.
Joe, could I answer that?
If you can in 34 seconds, you sure can.
I think he was unfit even before the charges. I don't think that he has the intellectual capacity or the moral capacity to be a leader, period.
And this was brought out on Rachel Maddow's program yesterday, and Wesley brings it up in a letter to us. If you want to just have your head spin a little bit more, in 2017, when they took a vote on human trafficking of children, Matt Gaetz was the only Congress member to vote against human trafficking legislation. We go to this letter from Sasha, and says, it is so upsetting when predators refer to the underage girls as women. In Gaetz's statement, I did not travel with a 17-year-old woman. A teenager is a child. It is a minor. Let's be clear. If these allegations are true, Gaetz had a sexual relationship with a child. That from Sasha.
Yeah, Joe, and if I could jump in on that, I also have already started to see the defense that she was age of consent, which is, again, not true according to the federal law. So you can already start to see some of the circles trying to circle the wagons around Gaetz with all of these ridiculous defenses.
My favorite part is that he's being punished for being overly generous to an ex-girlfriend. Is that the 17-year-old? I really want to know more about that. And that girl-woman thing, is that's the fault of Me Too. We don't know what to call 17, 18, 19-year-old women anymore. Yes, they are teenagers, but are they girls or women? This is we've made that confusing, and because we don't want to be infanticized. But obviously this is, he's going to call her a woman because it makes him seem less disgusting. And we will call her a girl because it makes him seem more of a monster.
Well, Valerie says that either way, by him calling her a woman, it makes him a slime ball, is what Valerie says. So whatever that's worth. Chris, were you going to say something?
No, I mean, I'm a little bit uncomfortable with it. Just everyone seeming to assume that he's guilty. I mean, he has flatly denied the claims, and I think that's important to keep mentioning. I'm always a little bit uncomfortable with stories that are, about investigations and they're about leaks because, it always raises the question of why did somebody leak this at the particular time? And I'm not saying that because I buy into Matt Gaetz's story at all about, the extortion and how this was supposed to be. Today was supposed to be a big day, and the story ruined all that. But, it is very hard for anybody, and even if people don't like Matt Gaetz, he does deserve the presumption of innocence. It's very hard for anybody to defend themselves against these kind of leaked allegations when there's no name on one, there's a name on one side and no name on the other, and I just think that's a very difficult situation.
I don't disagree.
Yeah, I bet that Lynn Cheney shares that view of him when he was out there campaigning against her when she tried to stop the impeachment, or when he burst into the chamber and tried to stop a very legitimate impeachment of Trump. I don't think there's anything wrong with enjoying the discomfort of these allegations against this man, and I am horribly.
You can just enjoy him all you want. I'm not saying you shouldn't enjoy him, but I'm just saying he deserves the presumption. Enjoy all you want, but he also deserves the presumption of innocence.
Absolutely.
I've been falsely accused of a terrible sex act, we'll see where it goes, but I'm not willing to assume that he's guilty just yet.
Chris, I agree with you. If you think about it, last week we were talking about the issue with Cuomo. And we said the same thing that, it's allegations and let the investigation play itself out. I absolutely agree with you. With that said, even with the allegations, I think it's fair game to talk about the hypocrisy of public positions that men in power have made.
Yeah. And, I'm all for letting the investigation go forward with Cuomo, too. But the one difference I would point to is that there are actually people with names who have come forward to make the allegations, and the governor hasn't denied some of them. So it's a very different situation, obviously. But
well, it also has become very convoluted, even on the congressman's part, in trying to defend himself of, he and his father wearing a wire. And I mean, it's just the whole thing.
Yeah, it's a bizarre.
It's a bizarre story made more bizarre by the accused himself.
Yeah. And that, like I said, that interview on Tucker Carlson last night was bizarre. And you could see that, as you said, Tucker Carlson described it as one of the weirdest interviews he's ever conducted. So there's a lot of strange aspects to the story, and I'm sure we'll learn a lot more going forward.
Chris Churchill on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, March 31st. Please note as you listen, any given topics, details, and facts may have changed and evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll return with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Roundtable producer Sarah LaDuc. On Thursday, Joe Donahue was out, so Ray Graff filled in. He and Alan Shartok welcomed Cohoes City Director of Operations Teresa Bourgeois, publisher emeritus of The Daily Freeman Ira Fussfeld, and counterterrorism expert and best-selling author Malcolm Nance.
President Biden announced a huge infrastructure plan to win the future. President Biden has outlined a $2.3 trillion plan to re-engineer the nation's infrastructure over the next 8 years. He's billing it as a once-in-a-generation investment in America that'll help the U.S. compete with China, create millions of jobs, promote tax fairness, and still not balloon the national debt. Some Republicans, okay, all Republicans, are skeptical that this will happen without huge tax increases. And in fact, there are some tax proposals included with this, and we'll get to that. First, let's go to WAMC's Alan Shartok. What do you make of this proposal?
Well, I think it's terrific. The Republican, remember, he was a Republican. General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, came up with the interstate highway system. That is beginning to crumble, as are roads all around the place. In our little Great Barrington, we have several, that's more than one, bridges that are down and don't seem to be repaired. We hear from the plaintive wails from the selectmen here in our little town that they're going to get around to it. But in the meantime, they haven't done it. So if our little town is representative of what is going on in the rest of the country, we need this, and we need it bad.
The proposal includes $115 billion to modernize bridges, highways, and roads that are in the worst shape, $85 billion for public transit. That doubles the federal government's commitment to repair and expand service. Also, $80 billion to modernize Amtrak's Northeast Corridor. And I have not been on that particular run in a long time, but I assume, Malcolm, you have been on that train. It needs a little work, right?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, once you go past Washington, D.C., are you aware that Amtrak trains are the lowest priority? They will literally stop a train for 10, 15, 30 minutes an hour for freight trains to go by. And if they can do that, if they can really expand and bring us into at least the 20th century, that would be pretty good. But the 21st century with high-speed rail, man, that's a lot of jobs.
I remember, Malcolm, when that used to happen on the New York to Hudson run. And we used to be sidetracked. Somehow they fixed that up, so it's not quite as bad as it once was. But it was terrible. Sometimes you'd wait an hour. And you're right about that. You're certainly right.
Teresa Bourgeois, you mentioned at the outset here that you are already planning what to do with the infrastructure funds. What sort of a guidance have you had? What sort of pre-word on how much you'll be getting have you gotten?
Well, you don't know how much you're getting, but you're looking at what the potential sources of funding are. And so we have $18 million in, you know, need for $18 million in our water treatment plant upgrades. We had a, here's an example. We had a sinkhole about a week ago. And when you open up the sinkhole and you look down there, our city engineer points to the photo and says, this is an 1895 pipe that broke.
1895.
A pipe that was put in there in 1895.
Made out of?
Clay.
Made out of clay. It was made out of clay?
Yeah, clay pipe.
Interesting.
So we have not all of our infrastructure. I mean, we're a historic city, and not all of our infrastructure is that old, but some of it is that old. And so whether you're talking about water infrastructure, water and sewer, wastewater treatment, you know, what goes into the rivers, there's a whole program called stormwater improvement, so you handle water better so you don't have pollution in your rivers, your roads, your, you know, lights, switching lights from to LED so you have energy savings. So we're doing energy audits on all of our buildings so that we know what improvements need to be made. We're doing streetscape designs, all of these things to get ready to be able to apply for and receive and spend these fundings. And, you know, just as Alan says, just in our community, there are millions and millions of dollars in necessary infrastructure that we could spend just in our community. And so this is extremely welcome news. And what it does is it will not only improve the infrastructure, but it will put people back to work, and then it will circulate money within the economy, because if you have construction workers, they're going to the local stewards to buy coffee, you know, they're going to the grocery stores, some people are stopping at the restaurants to pick up a slice of pizza. So not only does it improve the infrastructure, it circulates money through our community's economy, and therefore lifts up all of our economy.
But, I want to put a big but in here. Yeah,
okay,
well, I'm
right.
Not you.
Make your own joke there. All right, go ahead.
No, Ray and I were thinking along the same
lines. Go ahead,
okay,
sir.
So, we don't know that this thing is going to pass. It'll certainly pass in the House of Representatives, and it better before the Democrats lose it, if they lose it. But but on the other hand, the Senate is by no means a sure thing. We got Manchin and some of these other people who may not vote for it. And so it's going to be a tough road to hoe for Chuck Schumer and his colleagues to get it through there.
You know, I know you guys have talked about this with regard to the filibuster, Alan, and I'll throw this to you first, we'll throw it around the room. How important now, absent a change in the filibuster rules, how important is Manchin to all this?
Huge. He's absolutely huge. I would defer to Teresa or Malcolm.
Well, you know, I haven't heard from Ira yet, so...
Ira, I forgot about Ira.
Are you still awake, Ira?
You started talking about a big butt, and I figured you were tossing it over to me.
Ira. Oh, come on, Ira. I was thinking much more. That's not fair. I was thinking more of Ray.
Ouch.
So,
that hurts.
Don't pick on
Ray.
Well,
I very much... I'm in favor of the government doing something about infrastructure, and I'm in favor of them doing it big. And you know, this is like somebody who's let a house go without minor repairs, now it's time to make the big repairs, and it's very expensive. I have two points, one of which Alan touched on. The one point is that the definition of infrastructure, as is outlined yesterday by Biden, is rather broad. It's broader than what I think most people consider infrastructure to be, which is bridges and rail lines, et cetera. I think we need to hear a little bit more about some of the what I would call auxiliary items that go under an infrastructure bill. And the other thing is regarding the Republicans, they clearly are back into their position of being the party of no. And the question is, are they going to come back with some sort of a compromise or at least some sort of a proposal, which they didn't do during the 4 years of Trump, which would suggest that they don't, if they don't, it would suggest that they don't believe that infrastructure needs to be done, in which case, you know, hold hands because we're all going to fall through more sinkholes than the one Teresa just described.
Go ahead, Teresa.
There's not a member of Congress or senator who doesn't have a bridge in her or his state or district that needs to be repaired, or a road that needs to be repaired, or, you know, water pipes, or you know, in our case, City Hall. We have a historic City Hall. When it snows outside, it snows inside in the windows. And we are seeking funding for a comprehensive upgrade of our historic City Hall. There is not an elected member of Congress who does not have similar problems in his or her state or district. And so, of course, you know, infrastructure has been talked about for a long time, but even the person who wrote Trump's infrastructure bill was quoted last night, this morning, in a couple of articles, embracing this, saying that even the funding mechanism was an interesting approach. And so I think there's consensus that there needs to be something done on infrastructure, but we need to stop talking about it and getting it done and get it done.
Well, somebody's got to send that memo to McConnell, because his initial foray is it's too expensive, we can't do it.
Yeah. Well, the mayors of this country will send the memo to McConnell and to the, you know, those are the folks, that, you know, the mayors, the governors, the county executives, who have to deal with this crumbling. And you know who else should send the memo to him is the business people, because they rely on this infrastructure for their commerce, and they should demand this, just like Amtrak gets their people. Sorry, Alan, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
I think we're all sorry.
Yeah, no, I think we're all sorry, particularly me. But I do want to say that there's still the big bad guy out there. That's Trump. Now, you're quite right, Teresa. Trump had his own infrastructure plans. That didn't happen. Nevertheless, you know, we watched as not one single Republican deviated from the earlier great success that on COVID relief that was put out there. We don't know what Trump is going to say, and we don't know what McConnell is going to say. McConnell is saying it's too expensive. That says, okay, let's talk. Let's dicker on this thing. But if they do what they did on the other bill here, even though it is not, you're so right, Teresa, even though it's absolutely essential for their towns, cities, villages, and states, you know, they could do that because they're so scared of their stinking political careers.
Does it really matter what Trump says anymore?
No.
I think it absolutely does. If this
Where
guy,
is Trump's infrastructure plan? No, it wasn't one of the big jokes of his administration that every 2 weeks he promised that it was going to be a plan, and there never one never emerged. Did I miss one?
I don't want to be defending Trump. I'm not defending Trump. I'm simply castigating the Republicans who are scared of their own skins that he's going to get mad at them because he's indicating to a lot of people he will be the candidate the next time. And by the way, I believe that.
Now, we only have 2 minutes here before we have to break for news. And it's, by the way, the Roundtable Panel, and you can email us at panel@wamc.org. Before we break, one of the items that President Biden has mentioned in his infrastructure plan is $100 billion to upgrade the resilience of the power grid. And I wanted to go to our spy and our military guy, Malcolm Nance, here. Does the resilience of the power grid, is this hardening this to EMP?
You know, that. Let me define that for you. That's electromagnetic pulse. That means that if an atomic explosion of high neutrons and low, you know, radioactive yield explodes, it would fry all the electronics. Yeah, that standard was great for the Cold War when we used to think we could actually survive that. But, you know, man-made EMP is not a thing. It's not something that you really need to secure the grid to. The grid needs to be secured in the old school way, from hacking via mm-hmm. your electronic controls by having redundant manual controls. And they found that out in the Ukraine. Ukraine was attacked by Russia 3 times, where they literally seized control of their Russian-built power plants. The Russians had actually recreated of the control rooms and took it over and shut down power for over 1 million people for strategic purposes, right? For we don't know what kind of activities they were covering up, but they did it deliberately to send these messages. That's what we need to secure our grid for. Also, to be able to handle the kind of power we're going to need in 30, 40, 50 years. Not the, you know, I mean, our grid, let's be honest, was built on World War II. That's was the highest level of demand that we had. And we've just been improving upon, or not improving, we've been band-aiding it the whole time. So we could spend, if we spent $500 billion on the electrical and the power generation and putting it into solar and and giving more incentives for people to have solar.
Yeah.
I mean, you could make the United States almost energy independent.
Before we get to the letters, let's just go through some of the tax increases that President Biden's plan would be financed by. And if you are wondering what the plan is, yesterday he unveiled a $2.3 trillion infrastructure plan that he says would help us win the future. It's a nice phrase, but the future always wins, whether it's an asteroid strike or a nuclear war. The ending is usually the same. Biden's tax increases would be raising the corporate tax from 21% to 28%, one of the measures that over 15 years would cover the cost of this infrastructure plan and reduce the deficit, imposing a 21% global minimum tax. And I guess the plan here is that companies then couldn't avoid taxes by shifting to countries with low taxes. It would make it harder for businesses to merge with foreign companies to avoid taxes, a process that we now know is called inversion, eliminating tax breaks for companies that shift assets abroad, imposing a 15% minimum tax on the income that corporations report to shareholders, eliminating tax preferences for fossil fuels, increasing IRS audits of large corporations. That's it so far. Alan Chartok, A, is that enough? B, politically, is it too much?
No, I think if it's what he says it is, then he's going to be in great shape. The problem is that this stuff tends to come back down on the middle class taxpayer and the upper middle class taxpayer. And that would be unacceptable. So, from a political point of view, if he can keep it there, look, Ray, as you know, there are major corporations right around here. I'm not going to give two initials or anything like that.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Why would I do that?
I don't know.
But who pay nothing? Nothing. Not a nuka. Nothing. These laws have been written so that they get off scot-free. Off all too often. Not everybody, but all too often. And so, you know, there's an alternative minimum tax that we taxpayers pay. It's reprehensible. And, you know, just when you think you're doing good in terms of all of the laws, you're not. So I'm saying if he could keep it with the corporations and the businesses that are doing extremely well, I think most people will like it.
Alan Chartok on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, April 1st, which I just like to recognize. It is already April of 2021. That is wild. Truly outrageous. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. You may contact us by emailing roundtable@wamc.org. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the first weekend of April 2021 somehow already, I guess. Thank you.